Our beloved master. Sancho, a disciple of Rinzai, once said to Seppo, "The golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on?" Seppo said, "When you have got out of the net, I will tell you." Sancho said, "The renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot find even one word to say about this topic." Seppo said, "I am the chief abbot and have much to attend to." On another occasion, sometime later, Sancho said to a monk, "Where have you just come from?" The monk said, "Quats." Sancho said, "Quats." The monk again said, "Quats." Sancho said, "Quats." The monk said, "If you strike me blindly, I shall say, quats." Sancho picked up his staff, and the monk put himself in readiness to receive a hit. Sancho said, "When you go down a slope, there's no pleasure unless you run down it," at which he struck the monk. The monk said, "You robber," and went off. Another monk present at the scene asked, "The monk just now, how can he enter?" Sancho commented, "That chap had been to see the former teacher."
Friends, I have heard about an editor who was bitten by a mad dog. When he reached to the hospital, the doctor said it is too late. You are going to be mad. The editor said, "Just immediately bring me a paper and a fountain pen." The doctor said, "There is no hurry to make your will." He said, "Who is making the will? I want to write the names of the people whom I am going to bite when I become mad. I have been searching this editor and I have found him. He works here in this self-styled cultured city. In a Delhi newspaper, Prabhat, he has been editing in editorials absolute nonsense about me. Before I answer him, I want to thank him, because anybody writes about me any nonsense simply gives me an occasion, an opportunity to expose this self-styled religiousness, this so-called culture, utterly rotten. Before I answer him, I would tell one thing more. He did not die. On the contrary, the dog who has bitten him died. There are few people so poisonous that if a snake bites them, the snake dies. He is trying in every way to bite me, but I am not so available. So the poor fellow goes on writing editorials. I would love that he continues. I am absolutely grateful to him for the simple reason that he gives me an occasion to expose this rotten society and its religion and its culture. He has written about me that I am a lecherous professor, polluting the social and cultural climate. Okay. Do this editor remember, I have not made the statues of Khajuraho. They are 1,000 years old. I have not made the statues sensuous, utterly obscene of Puri or Konark. These statues of naked women in perverted postures, in thousands of numbers, it must have taken hundreds of years for the sculptors to make these temples. And these statues are not just pure work of art. They are part of religion. Otherwise, why put them in the temples? India has known the first lecherous men in Vatsayana. 3,000 years before, Sigmund Freud and Havelock Ellis, he wrote the first book in the world of sexuology, Kama Sutras, aphorisms on sex. And Hindus have been calling him Maharishi, the great seer. And his Kama Sutras are so ugly and obscene. He has also few sketches about sexual postures. Those sketches are so obscene, so ugly, so unnatural, and you will not believe that he describes 84 postures of making love. You know only one posture, that is the missionary posture. And this man is not called lecherous. He is called the great seer. And this man is for 3,000 years, never criticized by anyone. They have worshipped the man. And this poor editor calls me lecherous. The whole scriptures of Hindus are full of lechery, full of obscene sensuality. I will describe the milestones. The second man is a Kashmiri Brahmin who wrote the Kok Shastra. Koka is his name, Pandit Koka. It is far more ugly than what Sainas Kama Sutras. His sketches, and he used to have a love affair with a woman of the lowest caste, the Kolas. They are the aboriginals. Sometimes I wonder, joining Koka and Kola, perhaps the secret of Coca-Cola is there. That's why the manufacturers of Coca-Cola don't allow the secret to be known by anybody. And this poor fellow calls me lecherous, and Koka is called a great scholar, a great researcher in sexuology. In one of the Hindu scriptures, you will see the whole scene, what it means to be lecherous. You have seen the Shivalingas all over India. Perhaps there are more Shivalingas than anybody else's statues. Shivalinga simply means Shiva's sexual machinery. And it is based in the yoni of Parvati, his wife, and openly in the street corners, in the marketplaces, Shivalinga does not need even a temple, not necessarily. Even the poorest can afford it. Just find out a marble looking like a phallic symbol and make in the marble the vagina of a woman. Place the phallic symbol in the vagina and you have got Hindu's Mahadeva, the great god. How it came to happen that no other god has such symbols, I would like to tell you the story to explain the word lecherous. Just as Christians have Trinity. Hindus have Trimurti, three faces of God. The first face is Brahma, who creates the world. He has only one temple in the whole of India. Because who cares about him? He has already done his job and nobody knows where he has gone. The second face of the God is Vishnu, who has thousands of temples, because his work is to maintain what Brahma has created. Of course, if you can persuade him by your prayers and rituals, it will be a great blessing to you. He is constantly maintaining the universe till the moment when Shiva destroys it. Shiva is the destroyer God. How it came to happen that Shiva has got just a phallic symbol to represent him? One morning, Brahma and Vishnu were arguing about something and they could not come to a conclusion. So they thought it is better to go to Shiva. Perhaps he can help us to come to a conclusion. So they went to Shiva early in the morning. Americans should not think that only they make love in the morning. Millions of years before, Shiva was making love to Parvati in the morning with open doors. Brahma Vishnu never thought that this is the time to make love. But Shiva is a very strange god, a hippie god. He takes marijuana, he takes opium, he drinks alcohol. There is not a single drug that he is not addicted to. Naturally, he has no sense of time. Whether it is night or day, whether the door is open or closed. So Brahma and Vishnu entered the door and they could not believe their eyes. And I call these fellows lecherous. If they had any gentlemanship, they should have gone out of the house. But they remained there for 6 hours. Because that drug addict Shiva went on and on and on, not knowing when to stop. He did not bother that these two fellows are going around watching him, what he is doing. These are the lecherous gods of the Hindus. And when after 6 hours he came to his senses and recognized his two fellows, they cursed him. They should have cursed themselves because they have entered into somebody's privacy. Seeing that he is making love, they should have gone out and waited out. But they went round and round watching and enjoying. This is lechery. You will not find another example of such divine lechery. They should have cursed themselves, but rather than cursing themselves, they curse Shiva. That because we were here standing for 6 hours and you did not take any notice of us and you went on making love, it is so uncultured that we curse you, that you will be known in the world only with your genitals. That's why that Sivalinga you see all around the country. Now I would like the editor of Prabhat to answer me, who is lecherous? Your gods? And then I come to the father of this nation, Mahatma Gandhi. Till his wife was alive, Kasturba, her grave is just beyond the river in Aga Khan Palace. She died here in custody of British Empire. Mahatma Gandhi was also under house arrest in Aga Khan Palace. Kasturba was very much jealous of Gandhi because he was mixing with so many people, men and women. But she kept a constant vigilance. Once India's great poet Rabindranath Tagore was staying in Gandhi's ashram and Gandhi wanted to discuss many things to him. So he said, it will be good we sleep in the same room. Kasturba freaked out. She did not allow them to stay in one room. So up to Kasturba was alive, Gandhi was talking about brahmacharya, celibacy. In fact, everybody wants to be celibate as far as his wife is concerned. He wrote a book that celibacy is the true life. But it was just the fear of Kasturba and nothing else. When Kasturba died, he started sleeping with a naked woman. And all his followers have been trying to hide the fact, because they were worried his image of the father of nation will fall down into the mud. And unfortunately, the 3 persons who were constantly harassing him not to do this, all were from Maharashtra. One was Kaka Kalelkar, a long, lifelong friend of Mahatma Gandhi. Second was Vinoba Bhave, one of the most intimate followers of Mahatma Gandhi. And third was Dada Dharmadhikari. A A man who has been trying to philosophize Mahatma Gandhi's ordinary statements. All three belong to Maharashtra, the self-styled, cultured and religious society. But Mahatma Gandhi did not listen to anyone because of his constant repression, what he was been calling celibacy. Even after giving birth to 5 sons, he was repressing his sexuality, sensuality, and only repressed people become lecherous. Once the wife was dead, he forget all about brahmacharya, celibacy, he started in his old age, at the age of 70, he was having nocturnal dreams. And he is called the Mahatma, the great soul. And he started at the age of 70, sleeping with naked young girls. And the whole following was trying to hide the fact, but they could not hide it for a simple reason. Mahatma Gandhi's secretary, Pyarelal, was one of the most efficient secretary one can have. But because he fell in love with a woman, Gandhi kicked him out of the ashram. Nobody can, in Gandhi's ashram, fall in love. That is the greatest sin. Pyarelal was writing a biography of Gandhi. He knew all the secrets. Is he sleeping with naked girls? And because he was kicked out of the ashram, he may have some revenge also in his mind. That the man talks about celibacy to the public, and from the back door, he sleeps with young girls. The girls have to be naked. He wrote the biography. It is such a big volume, done with such accuracy of evidence, almost 2,000 pages, 2 volumes. So it is beyond the reach of ordinary public. Who is going to read 2,000 pages? And the sleeping with the naked girls comes in the end, 100 pages. With all the details, who were the girls, with all the letters that he received from Kaka Kalelkar, Vinoba Bhave, Dada Dharmadikari. Persuading him that stop this practice, this may destroy your image. But it was the last period of his life. What he has repressed for 40, 50 years has become a volcano. It was beyond his control. And this man, utterly immature, ignorant, calls me lecherous, call Mahatma Gandhi lecherous, call Brahma, Vishnu lecherous, call Shiva the first hippie of the world. But this is the situation with all the religions. Hinduism is not an exception. 500 pages in the Old Testament of the Bible are absolutely obscene. One friend of mine has taken out all the 500 pages, made a new book, X-rayed Holy Bible. Now the Christians are after him, but the book has gone, although banned by many countries, it has reached in an underground market. 500 pages, and no Jew, no Christian, because both believe in the Old Testament, have ever objected. Call these people lecherous, and these were the prophets who have been writing all these things. I am determined to expose everything without holding anything in my hands. So it is perfectly good that these people should continue to write against me. That will give me material, subject matters. Soon they will realize they are cutting their own heads. I am not a man who can be suppressed by just calling names. Criticize what I am saying. Look your face in the mirror and find out the passages in your scriptures. You will find much more, because I am only giving samples to my people. Another Marathi newspaper editor has asked me, how can in a body two souls live? As if he understands what a soul is. The soul is pure light. And in a room, you can have one candle, you can have 1,000 candles, because the light does not take space. The light is not a thing that takes the space. You can have 1,000, you can see around thousands of bulbs and thousands of lights. Their lights are not struggling for space, for territory. Light is not a space thing. And the soul consists only of the purest light, which does not need any fuel. So there is no question. The editor has asked if I can prove this. It is an already proved fact. I don't have to prove it. All over the world people know it already, that a man can be possessed by the spirits, not only one. The last account has been 16. 16 souls possessing one man's body. And if you want more data and research on the subject, you should go to Rajasthan, Jaipur, to have a look in the University of Rajasthan, because that is the only university in India which has a department for parapsychology. They have been collecting all the cases of possession by the spirits. So you will know that it is not a question at all of space. Two souls can be in one body without any difficulty. They don't have any conflict of territory. Just watch the light and you will understand. One candle or 1,000 candle in a small room, do you think there will be great chaos? 1,000 candles? Where they will find the space? Light does not need space. I am answering this question not for your sake, Mr. Editor. I am answering this question for my people to understand that the soul is pure light. That's why it has no weight. It does not occupy space. It has no limit as far as time is concerned. Hundreds of experiments have been done around the world by the scientists. In one experiment in Germany, they put a man who was just on the verge of death in a box made of absolutely transparent glass, so they can watch him while he is alive. From the outside, the box is completely sealed. They wanted to know if the soul leaves the body, how it can leave the box. We will catch hold of the soul. And if the soul leaves the body, the body must lose some weight. So they have weighed the body as accurately as possible. But the man died, nothing left the glass box, because for the soul, matter is not a hindrance. And you know, if X-rays can enter in your body and body cannot prevent them, you don't feel even that the X-rays are entering in your body when an X-ray film is taken. Soul is a far more refined, the ultimate light. So when it leaves the body, you cannot see it. If you have not seen it already within yourself, You will never be able to see anybody's soul leaving him. And then they opened the case, they could not find. So they weighed the dead man again, he had the same weight. For the materialist, it is enough proof there is no soul. Because nothing has left the box, and the man's dead body weighs the same as when he was living. It was enough for the materialist scientists to prove that there is no soul. It is not enough for me. Soul does not have a weight. Do you think light has a weight? Try. Put one candle on your weighing machine, unlit, weight, then give light to the candle and see whether it weighs more. There is no need to go to such lengths of finding a dying man. You can just try to weigh the light. It has no weight. But it does not prove that there is no light. It simply proves light belongs to a different category. It is not a thing. Hence, it has no weight. When you blow out a candle, do you see where the flame is going? Finding the door outside into the street, you don't see anything. The flame simply disappears into the universe, leaving no trace behind. The same is true about the soul. And the first editor goes on continuing that I am polluting the social and cultural climate. What social and cultural climate you have got? It was a man from this social and cultural atmosphere who killed Mahatma Gandhi. The first murder of its own kind. It is perfectly okay in America, but not in India. In America, 20% presidents of America have been murdered. That is routine. But Mahatma Gandhi's murder is the first of its own kind. And the man who murdered him belonged to this cultural social society. He was a citizen of this city. Effort has been made on my life in this city by throwing a knife to kill me. And I was informed that before your morning discourse from the police headquarters, that we have received an anonymous phone call that somebody is going to throw a knife at you and kill you. So allow 20 police officers, high ranking, but the whole thing was totally different. It came out finally into a very different conclusion. Those 20 police officers were sitting behind the man who has thrown the knife at me. They immediately surrounded the man in the name that they are arresting him. Unfortunately for the poor man, he was not an archer or a man who can manage to hit the target. The knife fell almost 6 feet away from me. What a great man they have found to kill me. They would have told me, I would have sit 6 feet away from myself. They did not allow my people to put a case because 10,000 sannyasins were present here. Eyewitnesses, you cannot find so many eyewitnesses for any murder or any attempt to murder. But the police officer said, we are present. We will take the case ourselves in the court. It is a police case. You don't need to bother at all. That was a strategy. They took away the knife also, that we have to present it before the magistrate. The knife was never presented. And the magistrate simply dismissed the case, that there is no case. Where are the evidences? And those 20 police officers remained silent. It was a good conspiracy between the magistrate and the police officers and the cultured citizens of this city. How I am polluting the social and cultural climate. I don't enter in your city at all. It is too polluted for me. It is the greatest polluted city in whole of Asia, and soon it will be the greatest polluted city in the whole world. I talk to my people, I never see the editors of Prabhat and editors of other Marathi daily papers, weekly papers, monthly magazines. I don't see here people from the city. My people belong to the whole globe. And those few people from the city who are here, they have been with me for 20 years. They are now beyond any cure. I have corrupted them so much that now there is no medicine, no deprogramming that can bring them back to the normal lunacy of this city. Just by the way, I would like to tell you a very beautiful case of a great evangelist who had millions of listeners on the radio and watchers on the television. In America, a new phenomenon is growing up, TV evangelism. What is the need to go to the people? Just you give the sermon on the television studio and it reaches to millions of homes. This man, television evangelist Jim Bakker, has returned to American TV again. Where he has gone and why? He had admitted to having sexual intercourse with his secretary and homosexual relations with a male preacher. This happened few months before. Then he went into seclusion just to avoid public because he was a great preacher and they thought God speaks through him. But when they found that he is having intercourses with his secretary and is not only heterosexual, he is perverted, he is having relationship with a male preacher, and he was talking to everybody about the greatness of celibacy on the television. These are the people who really destroy humanity and its trust. Now he is coming back. What excuse he has found? A great excuse. But it won't do as far as I am concerned. Now he is saying that the devil made him do it. And he was a representative of God. And God even did not care to interfere. And it was not one time, for years, the devil was telling him to do, to make love to the secretary, to make homosexual relationship with the preacher. It was the devil. What God was doing? If he cannot save his own preachers, do you think he will save you? Devil seems to be more powerful. He said the devil was jealous because I was forming a new church. But what about God? You were making a new church for God. God seems to be absolutely impotent. The devil managed for years, and you had been preaching about celibacy. You could not say to the people that devil has been forcing me to do things which I don't want to do. You were found red-handed making love to the secretary. And there was no devil present. Who was forcing you on the point of a gun that make love? You could have at least reported to the police station. It is not a coincidence that devil worship is growing all over the world, particularly in Christian countries. In England, there are now thousands and thousands of people who worship devil. In Australia, thousands of people worship devil. And these devil worshippers are Christians who have seen that God is important. Devil is far more powerful being. Obviously, Everybody wants to be on the side of the victorious. These Christians are throwing stones on churches, throwing stones on Christian preachers, that you are misleading people. You are telling people that God will save you. God cannot do anything. Devil is more powerful. It is the devil whom Adam and Eve listened, not to God. God behaved like a self-styled culture Punaite. Rather than persuading them, arguing with them, the way the devil has argued, God has told Adam and Eve that you should not eat fruits from two trees. One tree is of wisdom and another tree is of eternal life. I cannot in any way, I have tried in thousands of ways somehow to see the point. A father is preventing his own creation not to be wise, not to have eternal life. What kind of father? He must be counted as the greatest enemy, arch enemy of humanity. It was the devil who argued with Eve. He said, do you understand why God has prevented you from eating from these two trees? Because he is very jealous. He is afraid if you eat from these two trees, you will be a god yourself. He does not want you to be a god. He wants you to live naked like animals in the forest. And he said, if you don't believe me, you just eat and see. Eve could see the argument clearly. If the father loves you, he would have told insistently that eat more of the tree of wisdom and of the tree of eternal life. So soon you are grown up, so soon you realize your godliness. That would have been compassion, love. This is simply cruelty, violence, evil. Devil was the first revolutionary friend of humanity. And when Eve ate the fruit, her eyes opened. She saw a totally different world. She ran to Adam and told him to eat the fruit. They were caught red-handed by God. Rather than giving any argument against the devil, he behaved just like an idiot. He drove them away out of the paradise. In a small school, a teacher was telling the story and she asked, can you say something about the story? One small boy, Albert, stood up and he said, as far as I can understand, he must have driven them in an old Ford car. Driving them, out of paradise, what kind of car he was using. It must be T model, old Ford car, oldest, ancient most. The teacher was aghast. She said, I had never mentioned car. Albert said, you said he drove them out. This is ugly behavior on the part of God. And telling them that you have committed the greatest sin. Wisdom is sin. Then ignorance must be virtue. Searching for eternal life is sin. Then committing suicide must be a virtue. Adam and Eve could not reach to the other tree. Since then, man has been searching for eternal life. Have you ever realized what you are searching for? You are searching for more wisdom, enlightenment. You are searching for eternal life. A force which has no beginning and no end. I cannot say anything against the devil worshippers. They are doing the right thing. It is perfectly good if devil worshippers and God worshippers fight and destroy each other. It will be a great blessing to humanity. Whoever remains out will have all the joys of this planet and all the possibilities of growing in his potentiality to ultimate wisdom and to eternal life. Those two trees have to be found. If God comes in between, throw him away. Adam and Eve were very poor, naked, only two. Now, humanity is big enough. It can, rather being driven by God, can drive God out of the paradise. He has lived in paradise enough. Now just get lost. It's strange you don't read me. The self-styled city of culture. You don't listen me. Just my presence, I never go out, I never come except these 2 hours in the evening, in the ashram either. Living in my small room, almost 24 hours, if my presence is corrupting your city, then it needs to be corrupted. Then it is not worth saving. This ugly egoist attitude will destroy this city. Not by me, by these people who have been puffing the balloon of the ego that the city is cultural, religious, Go on puffing. Soon the balloon will burst. It will be you, the editors and the political leaders and the religious fanatics, who will destroy whatsoever culture you have. I don't know whether you have anything or not. As far as I am concerned, culture has not happened yet in the world. And you are giving all proofs of being uncultured. Taking a procession of my effigy on a donkey, you are showing your real faces. Not a single newspaper has condemned, not a single citizen has condemned the procession, that it is polluting the culture and the religious heritage. No, this is your culture. Bring as many donkeys as possible in your city and they will purify your city. The day is not far away when only donkeys will be living in this city. Of course, donkeys don't corrupt anybody's culture. They are such a silent, philosophical creatures. I have always loved them from my very childhood. I have always wondered why these poor creatures are condemned. They look so silent, standing in the shadows of the walls or trees. Just watch their faces. They look like Aristotle or Kant or Hegel or Feuerbach. Great philosophers thinking about great problems. Once in a while, they give a shout. That is the shout that wakes other donkeys who are falling asleep. Except that shout, they don't do any harm to anybody. They don't take processions. They don't shout ugly slogans. They are not worried at all that somebody will corrupt their culture. If you have culture, nobody can corrupt it. If you have religion, nobody can destroy it, because you don't have. You have only fallacy, fantasy, imagination, belief, but not reality. That's why you are so afraid. Anybody can destroy your false belief systems. That is the fear, the paranoia. But I am going to strike hard on all your false shadows so you can be discovered in your true, authentic, original face. The sutras. Our beloved master, Sanso, a disciple of Rinzai, once said to Seppo, "The golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on?" Zen always has many similar puzzles that cannot be solved. The ancient most puzzle out of which such puzzles have arisen is that one man was growing a goose into a bottle. When the goose was small, just out of the egg, he put it into the bottle. Then he went on feeding the goose in the bottle. The whole bottle is full of the goose. Now the goose is too big. It cannot be taken out from the mouth of the bottle. And the Zen masters have been asking how to take the goose out without breaking the bottle and without killing the goose. And people have been meditating on this, how to take the goose out without destroying the bottle or destroying the goose. There seems to be no solution. These riddles, these puzzles are not for solutions. They bring a revolution when you get an insight. And hundreds of people have become enlightened on such small puzzles, absurd. Months and years they will meditate. And they will not find any way. There is no way. There is no question of finding any way. But because they were only thinking about the goose and the bottle, for years the whole mind dropped. All thinking stopped. Their only concern was how to bring the goose out from the bottle. All logic failed, all reasoning failed, all thinking failed, the mind was of no help. They put the mind aside, and as they were in the space of no mind, they laughed. They ran to the master, and seeing their smiling faces, the master says, "So, the goose is out, and the disciple will touch the feet of the master. He will say, 'Yes, she has been always out.' The bottle was an illusion. You are always a Buddha. Your not being a Buddha is an illusion. The bottle is an illusion. You are always out of the bottle. All prisons that surround you of the mind, of the body, of the money, of the world are all irrelevant as far as your innermost being is concerned. It is not touched by anything. It is always out. Just it needs you to see the fact, and freedom comes from all directions to you." Seppo said, "When you have got out of the net, I will tell you." Seppo was a great master, just as Rinzai was a great master. Sancho was only a disciple. Seppo said to Sancho, "When you have got out of the net, I will tell you." right now, I don't see the point of wasting my time. You are not out, you will not understand. Just go and meditate. First get out of the net and then I will answer you. In fact, then there is no need to answer. This is the beauty of Zen. It brings to a point your own consciousness where there is no question and no answer is needed. You have simply gone beyond questions and answers. You can sing a song. You can paint a beautiful painting. You can play the music. You can dance. You can laugh. But you cannot say anything about what has happened to you. Seppo said, just get out of the net. Then come to me. I will tell you. Sancho said, the renowned teacher of 1500 monks cannot find even one word to say about this topic. Seppo had a great monastery of 1500 disciples. Sancho taunts him, provokes him. The renowned teacher of 1500 monks cannot find even one word to say about this topic. In fact, nobody can say a single word about the innermost freedom. Either you have it or you don't have it. But nobody can say anything about it. Even when you have it, you will not be able to say a single word. That Sancho does not understand yet. Seppo said, I am the chief abbot and have much to attend to. You just move away. First get out of the net, then come. Right now, I don't have any time to waste with you. It seems to be very unkind of Seppo, but it is not. He is helpless as every Buddha is helpless. There are things about which nothing can be said. You have to find them on your own accord. If somebody says something, he is your enemy, not a friend. Because whatever he says will become a block in your search. You will start thinking you know the answer, what is the need of seeking? And the answer is borrowed. It is not yours. If I drink the water, my quench is thirst. My thirst is quenched. If you drink the water, your thirst is quenched. So is the eternal waters of life. Drink out of them. Nobody can give you an explanation. Not even a single word to indicate the direction. Seppo was not unkind. He was simply telling him, you are too childish. You don't understand what you are asking. You will have to find it yourself. First, get out of the net. Right now, I have to attend to much affairs of my commune. I am the chief abbot. on another occasion, sometime later, Sanso said to a monk, "Where have you just come from?" The monk said, "Quads." Sanso said, "Quads?" The monk again said, "Quads." Sanso could not understand. He said, "Quads? You are coming from Quads?" The monk said, "If you strike me blindly, I shall say Quads." It will be easy to understand. If you just for a moment look at the scientific theory from where the universe has come, it was an explosion, quads, just a tremendous explosion, a chaos, and out of the chaos, slowly things started solidifying. The word quads does not mean anything, it simply means an explosion of sound. That's what our Yahoo means. When you shout quads, watch where it hits you. It hits just under your navel. That's where you are coming from. The life center is just under your navel, 2 inches under the navel. Hence in Japan, where they have exactly found the right center from where life has arisen in your body, when they want to commit suicide, they don't shoot their head, they don't shoot their heart, they shoot underneath the navel, exactly 2 inches underneath. Just a good knife, and without any sound, and without any torture, the man simply falls dead. Once the knife enters the center of your being, your life immediately leaves this body. This body is of no more of use. That is called in Japan very respectful. Because unless a man knows through meditation where exactly is the point, he cannot commit suicide by hitting that point. Hitting that point is just like making a puncture into a tire. The air goes out. Hitting at the center of your being, the being simply flies out, searching for another womb if you are not yet enlightened. If you are enlightened, It disappears into the blue sky of the ultimate. But quartz is a beautiful sound. There are very few sounds which have no meaning but immense significance. When Sanso said again, quartz, the monk said, if you strike me blindly, I shall say also quartz. I am also coming from quartz. If you are coming from quartz, it looks very absurd to the outsiders, but not to the Zen people. Zen has a multidimensional environment of its own. It is very difficult to understand Japan if you don't understand Zen. Here in the therapy groups, there is a problem. So many Japanese are coming and more will be on the way. Sigmund Freud and Carl Gustav Jung and Alfred Adler and Asagoli and Fritz, all the psychoanalysts of the best, know only Christianity and Judaism. Christianity is just a branch of Judaism, nothing more. They don't understand anything about the East. All these therapies are developed in the West. So every therapist tells to his participants that deep down you must hate your father, because Sigmund Freud's idea is that every girl is competitive to the mother. She hates the mother, she is jealous because she is monopolizing the father. She wants to have the father. So every girl hates the mother and loves the father, and vice versa. Every boy loves the mother and hates the father. All these therapies basically are founded on father or mother fixation. But therapists have been coming to me that we are in a difficulty. If to tell to a Japanese that you hate your mother, either he will kill himself or he will kill you. Because in Japan, anybody telling to somebody that you hate your mother, you have insulted his dignity. And when the dignity is insulted, humiliated, there are only two ways. Either he kills you or he kills himself. But both cannot exist anymore. So the therapist have been telling me what to do. Our whole therapy is Jewish and Christian. And with the Japanese, it does not apply at all. They have been brought up in a totally different atmosphere, where the mother is respected, loved, where the father is respected, loved, where from the very childhood, father and mother persuade the child to go to the monastery to learn meditation, to go to a Zen monk, to sit by his side just absorbing his fragrance, his presence, because ultimately you have to reach to the flowering of Buddhahood. It is a totally different orientation. How can a boy hate his mother who has been telling him to be just himself, go to the monastery, love how to be self-centered, and ultimately how to dissolve the center also, just to be nothing and pure, utterly empty. Only in emptiness no dust gathers, otherwise everywhere dust gathers. The father is persuading the child to learn from the masters, great masters. Even the emperors are sent by their fathers to learn something of your innermost being. If you don't know yourself, you are not worthy to be an emperor. First be an emperor of yourself. How can you hate your father who made you an emperor of yourself before giving you the succession of the outside empire? He had given you the inside empire. Zen has certainly created a tremendous rebellion against all cultures, all civilizations. As far as I see, Zen is going to be paving the path for the new man to come and for the new humanity to emerge. That's why I am talking so much on Zen. It is not without purpose. I want you to understand as deeply as possible. Sanso picked up his staff, and the monk put himself in readiness to receive a hit. Can you find anywhere in the world somebody getting ready, bowing down, giving his head to be hit? Nowhere in the world. Either if you are powerful, you will jump upon the person who is going to hit you. If you are weak, you will escape in time before he hits. But this is absolutely Zen. The monk gets ready on his knees as if to pray, bowing down, giving his head, "Hit me." He has not said it, but his readiness says it, that if you hit me, even the hit from a master is a gift, a presence which has no value in the marketplace, but which has value in the eternity of time. Sancho said, "You go down a slope, When I hit you, you go down the slope of the mountain. There is no pleasure unless you run down it. And remember not to go slowly. There is no pleasure unless you run down with a tremendous urgency as if you are going somewhere. Then the cool breeze and the beautiful sun rays and your running down, perhaps what you have not understood, while you have been with me, you may understand it. I am reminded of my own days of search. I used to get up early in the 3 o'clock when it was absolutely dark and there were still 3 or 4 hours for the sun to rise. I was living by the side of a beautiful park and there used to be nobody. I used to run . It is a tremendous joy. You are again a deer in the park, again a lion in the forest. Something of tremendous spirit arises in you. One old Sindhi used to have a small tea shop. That was the only shop by the corner of the garden. People coming in the daytime to the garden, that was the only garden, very beautiful and ancient trees. He had a good business of selling tea. He used to sleep in a small shelter in the night while I used to run. Many times he said, "Forgive me, sir. You wake me up and I know you are. But out of his sleep, I come perspiring and trembling, because at this time, nobody comes here and sometimes you are too much, because sometimes I used to run backwards. There was a huge field full of great bamboos. They made such a shadow that even in the full moon night, the road was covered with the shadows of the bamboos. So when I used to enter the shadows, nobody could see me. And when I will come out of the shadow, suddenly that old Sindhi will jump up from his cart and he will say again, "How many times I have convinced myself that this is that same young man, utterly crazy. But you will kill me one day. My heart beats so hard." Suddenly out of the shadows somebody comes, and that too running backwards in India, the mythology is that ghosts run backwards. That was the trouble. How to make the distinction that you are really you, not a ghost. And one day it happened. One milkman must have awoken early. It was 3 o'clock. He used to come near 5 or 6. But perhaps he was not having good sleep. Perhaps too many mosquitoes. Something may have been. He got early. He was having 2 buckets full of milk. When I came out of the shadows, dancing backwards, he threw away both the buckets and ran. And I, thinking that he has misunderstood me, so I ran after him. The more I ran, the faster he ran. I said, it is strange. The old Sindhi was watching the whole scene. He said, you will kill him. Why you are following him? I said, I simply want to say him that I am not a ghost. The old Sindhi said, nobody will believe. Ghosts always say that. You just give me those 2 buckets. In the morning, that fellow will come. I will give him the buckets and explain the situation. For years I inquired the old Sindhi whether the man has come. He said, no, those 2 buckets are there. I said, have you got any idea where he has gone? He said, no idea. Oftentimes I think you have killed him. He could not have survived that strange experience of a ghost following him. But I made every effort to find the man. Finally, I found him. He lived in a nearby village. So I went with those 2 buckets. The moment he saw me, he started jumping. He said, no, don't come here. I said, I have come just to give your bucket. He said, I don't want anything. With closed eyes, he won't see me. I said, you at least see me. You just look at my feet. They are not the way ghosts' feet are, backwards. The man looked at my feet. He said, so you are not a ghost? I said, one day I will become. But right now, I am not. He said, my God, I have been going around almost 2 miles unnecessarily just to avoid that spot where you have come running backwards. Don't do that. Anybody, I said, you don't know the beauty of it. He said, beauty? I said, you don't know the blessing of it. He said, don't persuade me. I said, just once, you come along with me. He thought for a moment and he said, it is better I should come. So that fear of that place is gone. So the next day I picked him from his village in my car, brought him to my house, and we both went jogging backwards. The old man jumped out of his car. He said, "My God, where you have found this another ghost?" I said, "He is not a ghost." He said, "I have told you, all ghosts say that." I said, "This is the same man who has dropped his milk buckets." He said, "Where you found him? You digged him from the grave?" I said, "You bring your torch and look at his feet. He is an alive man. He has not died. And you look at the buckets. You know the buckets. They have been lying with you for years." He said, "It is better I should change this place. It is becoming too heavy. Tomorrow you may bring third one." And in the darkness it is very difficult to make the distinction. "Can't you stop this jogging backward?" I said, "It is so beautiful." "It is such an ecstasy." He said, "What?" I said, "Unless you taste it." I said, "Ask the milkman." The milkman said, "It is true. It makes you feel so free." The old man said, "Then I will try tomorrow." His wife said, "No. You are not going to join these people. They are crazy and they are persuading you." I said, "Let him have a taste. Don't be worried, nothing will happen. I take the responsibility. And one day you will join us." He says, "You think I will join you? Then it is better we both join together. If something happens, it happens to both of us. I don't want to live alone without my husband." So both joined. I used to live with a friend, a very rich man. He has given me half of his bungalow. When he saw four men and one woman, two men on one side, two men on another side, one woman in the middle, he freaked out. He said, "It was okay you were doing alone, I know you. But I don't know these people, whether they are men, women, or just ghosts. And where you have found this woman? Either you drop this, or you take possession of the whole bungalow. I have another bungalow, I will leave." I said, "That will be very great. Because then I can entertain new ghosts, even allow them to sleep, just to get in time 3 o'clock. Actually, he moved. Sancho is saying rightly, when you go down a slope, There is no pleasure unless you run down, at which he struck the monk. The monk said, "You robber," and went off running on the slope. Zen creates beautiful anecdotes. What he is trying to say, I am telling you every day. Go in, not slowly, with your total consciousness, with an urgency, as if this is the last moment. Just like a spear piercing more than running, because the slope is very small. From your head to your being, there is very small space. Unless you really go fast, breaking all the bridges, breaking all the obstacles, you will not reach to your ultimate being. That's what Sancho meant. And the monk understood when he said, "You robber." It is a very loving expression. He is saying, "You have robbed me completely. You have convinced me completely. My heart is your heart. My being is in your hands." Another monk present at the scene asked, "The monk just now, how can he enter?" He understood he was a follower of Sancho. He understood what he means by running and not going slowly. The monk asked, "How can he enter by running down the slope?" Sancho commented that chap had been to see the former teacher. He has gone running to see his old master. The old master could not convince him. I have managed to convince him. The same thing the old master was saying to him, but he missed. Now he has gone back to the old master that you are right. It was just my thickness of intelligence, my hard skin, that nothing penetrated. But Sancho did the job within a minute. He gave me such a hit on the head, and I ran down the whole slope of the mountain. He was right. These are symbolic words. Sancho is saying, "I am hitting you. From that point, there is a slope from the head to the heart to the being. Go running. Don't stop anywhere and don't be slow. Nobody knows of the other second. This second may be the last one." So he has gone to pay respects to his old master. Busson wrote, "The sea at springtime All day it rises and falls. Yes, rises and falls. You have to visualize again. The sea at springtime, all day it rises and falls. Yes, rises and falls. He is saying, without saying the ultimate truth of your being, you rise, but you don't rise to the ultimate peak from where there is no fall. You rise a little bit and fall again. Again you hear another master, you rise a little more and you fall again. Unless you rise to the ultimate peak, to the hilltop, from where there is no coming back, you have been doing just a futile exercise like the ocean waves, rising and falling, rising and falling since eternity. When you will stop this, when you will rise and rise and rise, and there is no fall again. This I call the Buddhahood. This I call the awakened being. Manisha has asked a question. Our beloved master, do we really have to come back from the let go? Last night, especially, it felt as if you could have talked us into enlightenment. Manisha, I have Nivedana ready. The moment I see you are going beyond the limit from where you will not be able to return back, I immediately call Nivedana. You have to be here with me. So much has to be done for humanity. So I take you to the point, but not to the ultimate point. I just allow you a glimpse, and the moment I see you are going ahead, I immediately call you back. You have to be here till I am here. So much remains undone. The whole humanity, without knowing, is waiting for someone to make them conscious, alert, to help them to become a Buddha. They may not know. They may even fight you. It used to happen. The most important German philosopher, Immanuel Kant, never married. Not that he was in favor of celibacy, but because he was a great thinker. A woman has asked him, he said, I will have to think about it. It is a great matter. He took 3 years of deep research about all the points in favor of marriage and against marriage, they were all equal. His servant said, "Don't waste time. Although you have found pro and cons equal, but one thing remains more in favor of marriage." He said, "What is that?" The servant said, "The experience. Without marriage, you will not have any experience. With marriage, you will have some experience. I don't say good or bad, but some experience certainly. That remains one point more." It was so convincing, he went immediately to the house of the woman, knocked on the door, the father opened. He said, "I am willing to marry your daughter." He said, "My son, you are too late. She is married, she has two children. What you have been doing all this time?" He said, "I have been researching all the points, pro and con." So the old man said, "You found more points favorable?" He said, "No, it is my servant who said to me that it is always good to have the experience than not to have it. One never knows, something good may turn out. And even if something bad turns out, it makes you more experienced." So he remained a bachelor. No other woman ever asked him, and he was not a man to ask anybody. He was dependent on this servant. The servant went on asking for more salary, and he had to give. Because no other servant was able to stay with him. He was a very strange fellow, and the most strange thing was that he used to work like a clock. When he used to go to the university, people will fix their watches. It was enough that he is going, that means their watches are not right. When he will come back, every day the same, even on Sundays, when there was no need to go to the university, just to keep the routine, he will go to the university, sit in the library, and come back at the same time as usual. 3 o'clock in the morning, he had to be awakened. And 9 o'clock in the evening, he had to be forced into bed. That all has to be done by the servant. He was paying him immense salary with the condition that when it is 9, whatever happens, I may fight with you, that I have some immediately urgent work to do. Don't listen to me. You have to force me in the bed. Even if you have to beat me, you are allowed. But remember, I will give you a good fight." It was a strange scene every evening, 9 o'clock. Every morning, 3 o'clock, it was such a chaos that the whole neighborhood woke up. The servant is pulling him out. and he is going back under the blanket. He is shouting, abusing, and the servant is beating him, slapping him. This is the situation of whole humanity. Manisha, you all have to live to wake up people even against their will. In spite of them, don't bother. If they hit you, if they cry, if they shout, you go on pulling them. They have to be made Buddhas. That's why I don't allow you to go beyond the limit. I am watching closely everyone. It is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Hiram T. Horace, the third, the American diplomat in Paris, is approached by his son Hiram Jr. Dad, ask Hiram Jr., what does inflation mean? Well, son, says Hiram Sr., it means a general price increase. Really? Ask Hiram Jr., and what difference does that make? Well, son, explains Hiram T. Horace the third, I would put it this way. Here in Paris, before inflation, for me life was wine, restaurants and women. Since inflation, now it is beer, eating at home and your mother. Ziggy Zoldos, a Czechoslovakian citizen, is condemned to a jail sentence of 15 years for calling the Communist Party chairman an idiot. Bernie Beanball, the foreign correspondent for the New Age Times, asks a government official why Jiggy's sentence is so severe. Surely, says Bernie, the jail sentence for personal insults is never more than 12 months. That's right, snaps the party man. But he was not condemned for insults. He was convicted for revealing a state secret. Farmer Scrumpy decides to pay a call on his old friend Farmer Zack. He finds Zack leaning on the fence of the hog pen, is smoking his pipe and humming a song. "Hi, Jack," says Scrumpy, looking around the farm. "How have things been with you lately?" "Ah, pretty tolerable," replies Jack. "I had some trees that needed cutting, but a tornado came along and saved me the trouble." "Really?" asks Scrumpy. Says Jack. "Then the branches were lying there and needed burning, but lightning set fire to them and saved me the trouble." "Really?" ass is crumpy. So what are you going to do now? Well, nothing much, replies Zack, sucking on his pipe. I figured I would just wait here until the potatoes get shaken out of the ground by an earthquake. Nivedana. Silent. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to look inwards. But go running with your full consciousness, total life energy, and an urgency. That one never knows. This may be the last moment of your life. You have to become a Buddha. Go just piercing your astral body to the very center of your being. As you go closer, as you go deeper, a great silence descends on you. A little more. And a peace that you have never known before surrounds you. A little more, and you are at the center of your being. This moment, you are the most fortunate beings on the earth. A great ecstasy starts flowering in the very center of your being, like a lotus. The fragrance is of another world. The only quality you have to remember is witness everything, but don't get identified with anything. You are not the body, you are not the mind, you are not the astral body full of light. You are only a witness centered, just watching, reflecting like a mirror. On this mirror, no dust ever gathers. To make it clear, Nivedana, relax, but remember to witness. Just be a witness of everything that is happening. The moment you are only a witness, you will feel you are melting into an ocean, just like ice melts. Gautam the Buddha auditorium at this moment has become an ocean of consciousness without any ripples. You have merged into each other. This is the first experience, the first glimpse. This seed will grow in time, and suddenly one day you will find the spring has come. You are a Buddha, the awakened one, the ultimate search of all the seekers of truth. Collect as much ecstasy, as much blissfulness, as much benediction, and persuade the Buddha to come with you to the circumference of your life, in your everyday work, in your words, in your gestures, in your silences. He has to be present. Slowly, slowly you disappear and only Buddha remains. From that point, when only the Buddha remains, you can jump into the cosmos, a quantum leap, and disappear without leaving any trace behind. This is the ultimate goal of existence for all living beings, particularly for human beings, because they are the highest evolved. Before Nivedana calls you back, persuade the Buddha. It is not someone else, it is your very being. Nivedana, come back. But now come back as the Buddha, filled with joy, blissfulness, grace. A deep silence. Sit for a few moments just to remember the path, the golden path that you have traveled. And just rejoice in the fact that you have been able to melt and merge, that you have been able to encounter your authentic self, the Buddha. And remember to share your fire, to share your gold, to all and sundry. To friend and enemy. To the acquainted and to the stranger. The whole humanity is ours. They may not know, but we know. They may struggle against us, But we can only feel compassion for them. Remember, one seed can make the whole earth green. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, beloved Master.